Good morning, everyone. I apologize for the delay, just some scheduling issues this morning. Welcome to our House Committee on Transportation Policy this fine April 5th, 2017. We have a very busy schedule today, so we're going to move quickly. I'd like to begin with a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3118. So I will open a public hearing and work session and ask Mr. Walker to give us a brief as to what this bill does.
Chairman McEwen, members of the committee, House Bill 3118 authorizes issuance of lottery bonds to finance repair or replacement of the Siuslaw River bulkhead. The Legislative Revenue Office has issued a revenue light, which is sufficient to move the bill, and LFO has issued a fiscal impact statement. The bill has a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
And I believe we have one witness who has signed up. Steve? Oh, you are here. I'm sorry. I was scanning, trying to see you.
Just up in the back.
Thank you. Welcome to our committee morning, sir. We appreciate you coming to talk to us about the port of Siuslaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. This bill supports a failing bulkhead, replacement of a failing bulkhead. Oh, I'm sorry. Stephen Laskin, General Manager of Port of Siuslaw. So I just want to start with a little definitions. A bulkhead is something that keeps the earth in, whereas a seawall, something that keeps the sea out. And so you can think of a seawall as being, you know, a big pile of rocks with the waves crashing. That's not what we've got. We've got a bulkhead that stops our land from moving into the Siuslaw River. And that bulkhead is 30 years old. It sits in a brackish environment. It's made of wood piles. It's built of piles and timber coated in creosol. It's now at the end of its useful life. It's failing. We have restraining straps at the bottom that are failing. We have rotting wood. We have earth that's pushing out through the bottom. We have the actual bulkhead has lost about 2 feet in height, so it's sinking. The elevation of the area around it is also sinking. My maintenance people tell me it can't even be mowed anymore with a ride mower because the angle is so great now. This bulkhead supports several port assets. It supports a step-funded fish cleaning station. It actually supports two fish cleaning stations. It supports a pump-out station that supports the campground. It supports a parking structure that supports the fishery. During the summers and during salmon season, that fishing lot is full. And this bulkhead supports that fishing, that parking lot. Loss of this bulkhead, eventually it will fail, and it's moving in the direction of failing, and parts of it will start to fail, and then other parts will follow more quickly after that. It will mean the loss of use of a fuel tank, of docks, pump-out stations, as I mentioned, and it will impact recreational fishing in the area. This bill supports replacement of the bulkhead. There's an engineering study. I don't know if it got to the committee, but we did. I did forward the engineering study that was done a couple years ago, and that study builds a steel wall a couple feet behind the existing timber structure, and then the timber structure will be removed. Steel wall has an expected useful life of 30 to 50 years. The proposal that is in the bill, the estimate in the bill, is $1.185 million. That's just for the construction. There's still other costs that the port will have to absorb. So that's not a full estimate, and the port will have its skin in the game in terms of the actual engineering of the project, the actual permitting of the project, loss of revenue, and other ancillary expenses. So this is a start. This will get us going, but we will still have to come up with quite a bit of cash on our own to get the project completed.
I think we call that skin in the game, sir.
That's the point. It is skin in the game.
Are there any questions for the director This is fairly straightforward. Yes, Representative Wilson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I don't specifically have a question for the guest today, but I would for you. I am new to the committee, and I am not entirely aware of how things work here as it relates to monetary requests from various communities that I presume will come in, that, and I presume are transportation related. But and I haven't seen what's coming over from the Senate either. Will we as a committee, as we move forward, be looking at a lot of different things like this from various communities who come in before us?
There may be a handful. I haven't looked at the Senate docket yet. What is a common practice is to take a request like this, refer it down to Ways and Means, and it will sit there until the session unfolds, and at the end of the day, the wise people who sit on the Ways and Means Committee will make decisions as to how these will be either worked or not worked. Okay. So the decisions will be made further down the road. So right. The goal here is just to take this request, move it to Ways and Means, and let it sit there until we know what our budget situation looks like at the end of the year.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Any other further comments, Director?
No, that's my testimony.
All right. Thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
You're very welcome. And I'm going to look to you all to see this is fairly straightforward and simple. This has been scheduled for a public hearing and a work session. If you all are comfortable, we could work this bill and send it down to Ways and Means today. I'm looking at nods. I will turn to my vice chair.
Chair McEwen, I move House Bill 3118 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Meek moves House Bill 3118 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there discussion? Yes,
Representative Chair. I'm kind of following Representative Wilson's comments, but this, when we decide, I mean, this to me struggle with coming under transportation, but maybe under economic development. And so there's kind of a between the two different committees, maybe. But does this have more to do with transportation than it does economic development? As I read in here, that it will create jobs and further economic development. So.
I think when these bills come, a decision is made depending on where the best fit is. We have 23 ports. 23 ports do directly impact transportation in my mind. That's why I think in this transportation package, for the first time, I raised the issue of dredging as being part of a transportation infrastructure. Waterways are transportation. This is how people move. It's how vessels move. So I certainly can make the argument that this has to do with protecting a waterway. It's protecting an upland that has to do with how a port functions on the business side, but it also is protecting a waterway. Okay. So as a port person, I certainly can make that argument. Yeah. Now, why it came here and not to economic development, that would be a question for people who are above my pay grade.
Very good.
Yes. Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. So I understand the functionality here as well. We approve this. It goes to Ways and Means. It's fought out for different priorities. This vote is not saying this is a higher priority than other projects. It's simply allowing the process to unfold.
Exactly.
Okay.
There's no indication, as you all know, that if you take a vote in here, it impacts any other vote that you take. But it will go down there and be considered at some point in time by the full Ways and Means Committee. Actually, go to the sub first, I think. Correct, Tim?
Correct.
It'll go to the Ways and Means sub on transportation, and then they'll make a decision also as well. So it'll be vetted one more time. Any other questions? Clerk, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Noble?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Representative Barreto?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative McLean?
Aye.
Vice Chair Meek.
Aye.
Vice Chair Biles.
Aye.
Chair McEwen.
Aye. Motion carries. And we do not need a carrier because it's going other places first. Next, we have on our docket a public hearing on House Bill 3125. Mr. Walker.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, House Bill 3125. The original measure requires the Department of Transportation to study options for improving highway infrastructure. There are two amendments. The Dash 1 amendment replaces the measure, defines an auto cycle, clarifies that a Class C license is required for operation of an auto cycle, directs the Department of Transportation to report to the Legislative Assembly no later than September 1st, 2021 on changes to federal law related to auto cycles. The Dash 2 amendment is essentially the same as the Dash 1, but it adds an emergency clause effective upon passage.
And I have Mr. Peden, Mr. Burke, and Ms. Joyce, please. Oh, Ms. Joyce, I understand, is in another committee, so hopefully she will join us soon. Gentlemen, enlighten us about auto cycles, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Greg Peden here on behalf of Polaris Industries. With me is J.R. Burke, head of government affairs for Polaris. He's in town today from Minneapolis. The auto cycle is the product that we're discussing. You should have a briefing packet from us since I know it's been posted on OLIS. Hopefully you've all had a chance to look at it because it has some photos or images of what we're talking about, which is somewhat of a unique new product on the market. And JR is going to, I think, walk you through what the product is, why it's different than a existing motorcycle, or a little bit different than an automobile as well, and talk about the regulations. So with that, JR.
Welcome, sir.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is J.R. Burke. I'm the Senior Manager of North America Government Relations for Polaris Industries. As Mr. Peden mentioned, Polaris is the producer of the Polaris Slingshot, and some more details are in a packet that you should have received. The Slingshot was introduced in late 2014 and is currently available on the market here in Oregon as a motorcycle. That's how it is titled and registered. With that comes the requirement that individual operators shall be required to carry a motorcycle endorsement. As you can see from the materials that you have, the vehicle is somewhat unique from traditional motorcycles that you've seen, and frankly, Polaris also produces Victory and Indian motorcycles, in that you don't straddle the seat, you don't use handlebars, you use a steering wheel, and you use bucket seats. It also has two forward wheels, and this product actually comes with significantly or very dynamic safety features like traction and stability control, analog braking systems. It also comes equipped with seat belts and so on and so forth. So what happened was, when we went to market with this, at the same time, the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators, otherwise known as AMVA, which is made up of subject matter experts from departments of transportation, law enforcement, and otherwise, came together and created a best practices for how these vehicles should be treated because they are federally classified as motorcycles. And the reason they're federally classified as motorcycles is they have fewer than four wheels. So they have three or fewer wheels in contact with the ground, and they meet certain weight requirements. But those are the only two major distinguishing factors from automobiles under federal law. The same persists here in Oregon, in that it is a motor vehicle. A motorcycle is a motor vehicle with three or fewer wheels in contact with the ground with a seat or saddle. These vehicles have a steering wheel. They have bucket seats. They have pedals at the floor. This particular vehicle that Polaris produces has a manual transmission. So it operates very much like a car. So the second recommendation that the AMVA experts made was that because of the unique operating characteristics of these products, they should be exempted from having to require the operators to carry a motorcycle endorsement. When we first came to Oregon, to market in Oregon, that was one of the key features of our independently owned dealers here in the state brought to our attention, is that customers are going to come into our dealerships and they're going to be confused about what sort of operator licensing is going to be required to operate these products. And they view it basically as a small business trying to grow as a barrier to entry that doesn't make sense. The AMBA folks seem to agree in their recommendations that that is indeed the case. So we are here, and this amendment would essentially do two things. It would create a specific definition for auto cycle, distinguishing it from those motorcycles that are traditionally thought of as handlebars, straddle seats, and so on and so forth, and instead talk about the steering wheel, seat belts, non-straddle seating, and so on. And then because of that, triggers the exemption from the motorcycle endorsement requirement. There's also a provision in the amendment which talks about not riding two abreast. Sometimes you'll see operators of motorcycles riding two abreast in a single lane. So to address that issue, for those folks who don't already know visually that they shouldn't be doing those sorts of things, this would provide that individual operators of motorcycles are not allowed to do such because they cannot literally fit two of them side by side or two abreast in a lane. So with that, I'm certainly happy to answer any questions, as I know this is a new product and a new concept. Thank you.
Ms. Joyce.
Chair McEwen and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. I was happy to work with the other two witnesses on this bill as we crafted an amendment to address some of the safety concerns that the department had. And so as you can see from the amendment, things like helmets are required, seat belts are required. These things are classified as motorcycles under the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards, the equipment standards, and that's understood. So and the primary piece being that you could operate one of these things with just a Class C license, no motorcycle endorsement. And clearly looking at these things, they look, you know, to all eyes, more like a car than like a two-wheeled motorcycle. These three-wheeled motorcycles pose an interesting problem for DMVs and departments of transportation. But the auto cycle definition seems to get to a place where a Class C license is appropriate to be able to operate that kind of a vehicle. So we're comfortable with the amendments.
All right. Thank you. Questions? Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is auto cycle a new term that is developed just right here in this committee?
Representative Barreto, no, it is not. In fact, the auto cycle term stemmed from this AMBA best practices. The first state to pass an auto cycle law was the state of Virginia, and this was in 2013, 2014. And since that time, there are now more than 30 states that have an auto cycle definition on the books to capture these sorts of unique motorcycles, all of which allow, as this amendment would, the exemption from having to carry a motorcycle endorsement. So this is something that has been, over the last few years, taking hold pretty aggressively across the states as a new concept for the treatment of these products. And in addition to the over 30 states that have an auto cycle law today, there are another half dozen or so legislatures that currently have active legislation, as this committee does, to address these issues.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Being a lifetime motorcycle rider, I think I can add something to the discussion here. I would just say if you, and by the way, nice rig, looks cool. But as great as it looks, if you show up at your motorcycle clubhouse driving, you won't be welcomed as a motorcycle rider.
Thank you for that clarification, Representative Wilson. Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. I prefer horses to motorcycles, so putting things kind of here, my question is, number one, if the feds still consider this a motorcycle, which it sounds like they do, what is the difference in terms of safety and fatality rates? I mean, what are we buying when we say you don't need to have any specialized additional training, good luck on this, with helmets and gloves? What are we buying with this?
Representative Evans, traditional two-wheel motorcycle training provides a couple of things unique to the way in which you operate this product. First, let's talk about logistics, just the types of maneuvers and so on and so forth that you're doing during the motorcycle skills testing. You're going to learn about things like counter steering, how to use active body positioning in order to operate a motorcycle safely. You're going to perform skills tests, which will require you to, for instance, operate a figure eight within a confined space. So that's on a two-wheel motorcycle that you're being taught those skills. And those are skills that are kind of above and beyond your traditional Class C driver's license skills test, of course, and the knowledge that you get from that. So these products, of course, are much wider and so on and so forth. So they present just kind of logistical challenges for the those individuals who conduct the safety trainings. So this, because of the exemption, that would no longer persist. The folks in with AMVA stated that because you are essentially operating this vehicle or this motorcycle as you would a regular passenger car, you've already been tested for those skills. It doesn't present the same challenges that you would under a regular safety or motorcycle safety environment. The other thing that I think is important, and I say this as also a representative of a very proud motorcycle company, meaning Victory and Indian Motorcycles, is that these products are fundamentally unique in that they don't tip over. That's a safety feature in and of itself. As a motorcycle enthusiast myself, if you look at the training courses and the materials that you provided, it talks about things about, taking it easy on a left-hand turn when it's wet out, or, standing when you're going over railroad tracks and things like that to counter the reaction of the suspension when you go over loose terrain or over railroad tracks and so on and so forth. Those things are not required in this type of product. The other thing which is important is the measure here would require the use of safety belts, which you don't have when you're operating a motorcycle. Instead, you are designed to detach from the motorcycle when you're operating it in the event of a collision. This product has a reinforced steel cage around you, rollover protection, as well as I mentioned earlier, the advantage of anti-lock braking systems. Yet, some two-wheel motorcycles do have those. Anti-lock braking systems, traction and stability control. I cannot speak to other manufacturers of auto cycles, but at least from Polaris's design standards, is we have also introduced crumple zones into the front end of these products. So we have taken great pains to kind of infuse as much safety features into this product as we can. I think the natural assumption could be made because of that as motorcycles, the statistics are actually aided, when grouped with other traditional motorcycles.
Representative Noble.
Thank you, Chair. I have more of a clarification. I'm assuming that this is related to a motorcycle simply because that's the genesis of the build. Different than a Can-Am Spyder, which you still straddle two wheels up front, one in the back. This, to me, seems more like a three-wheel convertible sports car, because I would agree they're not even allowed to ride the Sturgis with me. So I'm curious about, it's really more of a vehicle. The only hang-up that I understand is that it's three wheels instead of four. Is the helmet requirement just to help us transition from the motorcycle idea? Because convertible sports cars don't require helmets. Is there some other safety issue with this that's different than a normal convertible?
Chair McEwen and Representative Noble, I think from the department's perspective, the FMVSS, which are the federal vehicle equipment standards, there are different standards for passenger vehicles and for motorcycles. And so if you were to call this thing a passenger vehicle, then there are certain equipment features that this thing must have before it's legal to operate on the road. And I'm thinking that they don't meet all of those. So, again, a three-wheeled vehicle has always been classified as a motorcycle, whether it looked like a two-wheel motorcycle or not. So it continues under this bill as a subset of motorcycles. Helmets are very important to the department, and as a motorcycle, we deem it very important that folks have a helmet on and that that be required when operating a motorcycle.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Just real quickly,
yes.
Then. Mm-hmm. I think I remember there's some watching federal regulations as those change in the bill, or at least someone made a note of that in the literature, unless I totally spaced it. But because the vehicle dynamics, in being a former driving instructor, seem much more consistent with the vehicle, three- or four-wheel, than a motorcycle that I ride. And you outlined the differences. So I'm just curious as to how this is going to progress over time.
Vice Chair Vile.
Madam Chair, what's the significance relative to insurance for these vehicles?
Chair McEwen, Representative Vile, it's a great question. I think I'm going to piggyback your question on the last point that Representative Noel made, which is these vehicles are today titled and registered as a motorcycle, like I suggested. Therefore, they are currently being insured as motorcycles. I think the advantage of the way that this legislation is constructed is that as a subtype of motorcycle, you're able to retain the umbrella of the overall motorcycle regulations that are in place right now, standardized practices when it comes to insurance. Of course, helmets is a big issue and something Polaris is a big supporter of, helmet use and so on and so forth. So I think in terms of an efficiency perspective, you get the umbrella allows you to retain those important pieces of the existing motorcycle construct under statute and regulation that these vehicles are currently being regulated under. You're not essentially recreating the wheel here, and all the things that come after recreating the wheel. You get to retain the existing insurance classification. So if you create a new definition, you know, what happens with underwriting? You know, it can't be a car because it doesn't have certain safety features like bumpers and so on and so forth that you would require for a passenger car to be underwritten and so on and so forth. So you don't run into those challenges. And so I think the way this bill is constructed allows you to take advantage of those efficiencies. The other key feature is that as in your packet, it shows the distinction between the frankly, lack of distinction between the definition at the federal level and here at the state level. So when we produced this product, we produced it to the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standard that was previously referenced. So it is classified as a motorcycle. With that comes we're federally required to put a compliance label on that lists the body type, and that body type has to coincide with its federal classification. So it says motorcycle on the product. We also provide every slingshot with a manufacturer certificate of origin, which is going to provide certain information that is important to ODOT and others to in order to properly title and register these products. They put the information in the system. That body type also is motorcycle. And the vehicle identification number as well, certain characters within that vehicle identification number, the VIN, also coincide back to the federal classification. So because it retains its motorcycle construct here in Oregon, it doesn't require you to disrupt existing practices with how these products are treated for purposes of the current owners, as well as any new processes or systems that need to be put in place by those who regulate the vehicle here.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative McLean, and then we really do need to move on. We've got
this is really
lots of work to do,
Ms. Joyce. We passed the dead red for motorcycles in the last session. So does that dead red, since they're qualified as a motorcycle, do they get to use that same standard?
Chair McEwen and Representative McLean, excellent memory from last session. I'd forgotten about that. I think the answer is yes, they would qualify, although I think the problems that lead to the situation where you would have a dead red with a two-wheeled motorcycle or a bicycle, I suspect are very unlikely to happen with this.
Amy, that's because of the substance of the...
And the amount of metal in the vehicle. That's my understanding.
Okay, thank you.
We just lost him. I want to move along, but I'd very briefly like you to the Dash One Amendment. Amy, is the amendment that you are all comfortable with to settle all the issues that ODOT had, correct?
Yes.
But I'd also want to address the Dash Two, so we can move this very quickly next week. Can you address the Dash Two, Mr. Peden, or
Jerry? You want to talk about the
Sure. Madam Chair, members, the Dash Two Amendment will essentially allow for an immediate effect upon signature of the governor of this legislation. One of the reasons that we have been supportive of this amendment is basically because we're at the height of the selling season of motorcycles here in the state of Oregon as well as elsewhere across the country, and our dealers here in the state have asked us to be able to take advantage of the effects of this law at the earliest opportunity that they can. So this is really about this amendment. Particular part of the legislation is really about supporting the independently owned dealers of these products across the state.
All right, thank you. Any other questions for the panel? All right, then I am going to close the public hearing on 3125. Thank you all, and open a public hearing on House Bill 3120. Mr. Walker.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, House Bill 3120 directs the Department of Transportation to designate vehicle dealer as agent for the purposes of preparing and or submitting documents related to vehicle titles, registration, liens, and other services related to complying with federal and state law. Allows the Department of Transportation to penalize vehicle dealers who do not comply with applicable registration. We have a Dash One amendment that makes some changes to clarify responsibilities.
And we have... Do we have a list?
I'm sure, Mr.
3220. There it is. I'd like to call it Mr. Oh boy. Remensberger? Was I close? And Ms. Joyce, please. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman McEwen. For the record, my name is Greg Remensberger. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. This bill is really a cleanup bill for an issue that was uncovered when the Treasury Department was researching an RFP that the Department of Motor Vehicles was going to issue. There is a statute that states that any dealer or any state-held funds need to be deposited into a segregated bank account within 24 hours of receipt, designed for hunting licenses, off-road permits, fishing license, et cetera, so that it doesn't get commingled with the retailer's normal banking funds. In the car business, the way our practice works is we do what's called spot delivery. So you come in, consumer comes in to purchase a vehicle, they qualify for financing, and we deliver the vehicle on the spot, hence the term spot delivery. We have 14 days to get finalization on the funding and fund the vehicle. We have an additional 15 days, so a total of 30 days, to complete the transaction with the Department of Motor Vehicles. There are times where that transaction within the first 14 days will unwind. So for us to put the money into the account before it's technically a completed deal is a little bit difficult and cumbersome for us. So we've been working with the Department of Motor Vehicles and Treasury to come up with a solution that would solve our problem, but still make sure that the funds were entitled to the state as desired by the initial statute. Both entities, the Department of Motor Vehicle and Treasury, has recognized that our industry, both new car dealers and used car dealers, don't have an issue with the funds not being paid. They would jeopardize their dealer's license, which allows them to do business, if they didn't meet those standards. So The solution that we came up with was to make dealers, in essence, agents of DMV, which would give them 30 days to complete and have the funds deposited in and transactions, and that's typically what happens. There is an occasion where if you don't get title back from the bank in order to transfer title and so forth on a used vehicle, it may go beyond those 30 days of which we're required to notify the consumer. This would still require, at that point, the dealer to deposit the money into a segregated fund at that point if it wasn't completed within those 30 days.
Ms. Joyce?
Chair McEwen and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. The bill does do a number of things, and to accomplish what Mr. Remsberger is discussing, there's a clarification in the bill about the agency relationship between the Department of Transportation, DMV, and vehicle dealers. So there's some cleanup language there, also specifying the rule writing authority that DMV has around this agency relationship. And a third piece that is also a cleanup, kind of apart from the issue that Mr. Remsberger identified, is the sanctionability. So when DMV sanctions a dealer whom we regulate in our business regulation group, the law could be read to say we have two enforcement authorities: take away the license or certificate, the ability to do business, or do nothing at all. So the bill also adds sort of a middle ground so that DMV can try to work with dealers, bring them back into compliance, get them to do some things to get them better educated or whatever. So there's a third piece in the Dash 1 amendment as well. And Mr. Remsberger worked with us on that, which we very much appreciate.
And I see no one here from Treasury, so I'm going to assume that they are comfortable with the outcome.
I communicated with the Treasury Department, and I understand that they were comfortable with this as a piece of the puzzle to fix the problem that Mr. Remsberger is talking about.
Thank you. Do we have questions on this bill? Seeing none. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3120. We're going to, let's do a very quick public hearing on House Bill 2288. Mr. Walker.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, House Bill 2288 authorizes issuance of lottery bonds for the Connect Oregon program, declares an emergency effective upon passage. This bill has a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. As you may remember with our conversations with ODOT earlier in the session, the Connect Oregon is a multimodal transportation fund, and it has gone through six iterations, and the state has received a total of about 6,000 project applications and funded a total of 279 projects.
And I have a number of people testifying, and I'd like to do this fairly quickly. Connect Oregon is a very well-known program. I think it's fair to say that with the development of a comprehensive transportation package in this session, where Connect Oregon is a topic of conversation, that this bill, in essence, is going to go to Ways and Means as a placeholder till we determine what the outcome of the transportation package is. I think it's fairly straightforward that we just want to get a bill down to Ways and Means until we determine if a transportation package is moving forward, in which case this will be a significant piece of that. So we're kind of in an interesting position with Connect Oregon this year, but I just wanted to preface it with that information. I would like to call John Charles, Cindy Robert, and Jerry Bohard, please. And then we have two others. So I'd like to do these as quickly as possible, because the next bill that we have up may take a little time. Welcome, Mr. Charles.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Charles, president of Cascade Policy Institute, and I have followed all the Connect Oregon programs since inception. And I do have two concerns. There are two unfortunate trends in the Connect Oregon program. One is deficit spending, and the other is subsidies from non-users to users. Deficit spending, selling of bonds of any type, cannibalizes future revenues. It's fun to pass bills now that spend now. But 10 years from now, people sitting in your seats, their job is a lot more difficult because they're paying principal and interest payments. According to the ODOT CAFR, Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, ODOT has $3.5 billion in P&I payments going out to 2041 from all their programs, lottery bonds, gas tax, geo bonds. According to the LFO memo prepared for the ODOT budget a couple weeks ago, quote, $416 million in highway funds are not available for roads and bridges in 2017-19 due to debt service on gas tax bonds. So I think the tendency to spend money you don't have and foist off the debt service on future generations is a trend that you should try and cut back on. Second point is subsidies from non-users to users encourages and rewards a lack of fiscal discipline on the people receiving all of these revenues. It's especially prominent in the transit industry. Just one point, the train operating by ODOT from Portland to Eugene has a subsidy per one-way boarding of $118. That's only happening because you keep enabling the dysfunction. All travelers can be identified and charged a user fee. And this bill allows them to skate that and to be subsidized by someone else. My own view is that all modes should be using user fees and get 100% cost recovery from the users. If that's the case, you don't need this kind of approach. So my final point is I think we have a deficit spending addiction problem in this building, and I suggest that you stage an intervention and table the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert. I'm here for Union Pacific Railroad. I'm always worried when someone says they're short on time and we need to move quickly that I'm just going to say everything I was planning to say and say it really fast.
Thank
no one's
going
to understand anything I said. So instead, I'm going to shorten what I was planning to say and simply say to you that Connect Oregon is a model, a public-private partnership model that Union Pacific uses nationwide to talk about how it should be done. It's an excellent program. We have 23 states. We have lots of projects. We usually spend most of our money, billions of dollars, both us and BNSF, on capital investments. Capacity expansion is something that's a little bit harder and has to have a different kind of return on investment. When you look at Connect Oregon and the change it has made on return on investment in Oregon, while we have lots of projects we want to do and we will get to them, Connect Oregon makes those projects rise up quicker. And it's better not just for us, but also for those communities around us and for Amtrak. As a matter of fact, one of our most recent projects, Harrisburg Bridge down in Lane County area, we paid 75%, I believe it was, and the state paid 25%. But it allowed us to upgrade a bridge that really wasn't a problem for us, but was a problem for Amtrak. So it made it really clear that we can invest this money, we had a good return on investment at that point in time, and can do something for the community that they thought was really important. Excellent program. We hope you continue it. If you all have any questions about the projects we've done, the matches we've done, the ongoing success of those projects, I'm happy to come to your office at any time and use your time and not the chair's time.
Thank you. Ms. Bohard.
excuse me. Good morning, Chair McEwen, committee members. For the record, my name is Jerry Bohard. I'm with the Oregon Department of Transportation. Just want to speak a little briefly to the history and the status of Connect Oregon. It does cover the non-highway modes of aviation, rail, marine, transit, and bike ped, with the primary purpose to promote economic development and create jobs. The legislature created Connect Oregon back in 2005. In 2005, it was $100 million, as was in 2007 and 2009. 2011, $40 million was allocated, and then in 2013, $42, and then in 2015, $45 million. This led to $427 million that has led to 279 projects that have been funded. But I think most importantly, it's leveraged close to $700 million of private investment. And as of March, 90% of the Connect 1 through Connect 5 projects are complete. Last August, the Transportation Commission approved 39 projects through Connect Oregon 6, and construction has begun on the majority of those projects. Important to note that the governor's budget does recommend $71.1 million for Connect 7. So in closing, we support this additional round of Connect Oregon because it's proven to be a valuable and successful program. So,
questions for this panel? Thank you very much, everyone. Next, Ms. Butterfield, Mr. Landauer, and Ms. Dalton, please. Good morning. morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lana Butterfield, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Rail Users League, or ORUL. And ORUL has supported every single Connect Oregon program since its inception. We think it is a highly valuable program and investment in the transportation system of the state. I know that Representative Witt has a lot of projects in his district, and in fact, one of his letters to other legislators is posted on our website. So if you want to see his letter and others, you can go to orule.org and look under legislation. And although it's somewhat dated, there's a lot of information about Connect Oregon and its value. I won't go into all the jobs that it's created, but know that you have our enthusiastic support.
Thank you, Ms. Butterfield. Mr. Landauer, welcome.
Good morning, Chair McEwen, members of the committee. My name is Mark Landauer. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Public Ports Association. With obviously the direction of the chair, I just want to say a few quick words. This has been a fantastically wildly successful program for a number of transportation sectors that just simply don't have access to the traditional transportation funding stream that we have in this state. As many of you know, much of the funding for our transportation system is confined to the constitutional dedication to the right-of-way. For my members, needless to say, they are not necessarily on the right-of-way. They are on waterways, and as a result are barred from gaining access to those types of funds. This has been a program. Our ports, all 23 of our ports, are responsible for direct, indirect, or inducing over 100,000 jobs in this state, according to a 2014 study by Business Oregon. They generate over $15 billion in economic activity. This is the one program that they have access to that assists them in moving freight to and from markets, whether it be within the state, within the U.S., or internationally. This program assists in retaining existing jobs, expanding jobs in communities throughout the state, and I would commend the bill and ask that you move it to the Ways and Means Committee without haste. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Dalton.
Chairman Cuban, members of the committee, Amanda Dalton, I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Wheat Growers. We represent nearly 2,000 farms across Oregon that produce wheat, one of our state's largest and most valuable crops. The Connect Oregon program has provided important investments in Oregon's transportation infrastructure for many years, as I'm sure you've heard. The league is very supportive of HB 2288 that would provide lottery-backed bonds for Connect Oregon 7 program. The Connect Oregon approach of matching state funding with local investment has a long track record of success in getting key multimodal infrastructure projects completed. The vigorous competition and rigorous review process for these grants ensures that the best projects with the best returns to Oregon citizens and economy get funded. As an example, the Connect Oregon 6 program provided critical matching funds for a project at the Port of Morrow that will be beneficial to Oregon's wheat industry and local farmers. The expansion of grain loading capacity and the addition of rail car loading and unloading capability will provide more efficient transportation, improve competition, reduce carbon emissions, increase employment, and facilitate additional investments in local dairies and grain processing. This project will provide returns to Oregon's investment for years to come. We know that there will be many important projects that could be facilitated by additional Connect Oregon funding, and if there are any possibility that these investments of Connect Oregon dollars could help unlock the economic disaster caused by the loss of container service at the Port of Portland, we would rank that project first amongst all others. Container service is that important to Oregon farmers, our manufacturers, and our customers. We hope you will join us in supporting House Bill 2288 to continue the great work that has been accomplished by the Connect Oregon program. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dalton. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Is anyone else speaking to Connect? Did you want to also come?
Thank you.
Okay, I thought maybe it was one or the other. And very briefly, please.
I will. Thank you.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, my name is Marianne Nash. Today, on behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau, would like to echo most of what Amanda Dalton just said. This is a very important program that's made a lot of key investments. Wanted to call attention to one aspect of the program that we've seen come up a couple of times, and that is the use of Connect Oregon dollars for bike paths for Rails to Trails projects. And there is some confusion on the land use side about the land use process, and a couple of projects have gone through, I think, without awareness of some of the local opposition and kind of a full view of local engagement around the issue. And so moving forward with the Connect Oregon process, specifically as it relates to bike paths, we would just like to see an increased focus on making sure that opponents to projects are, have an opportunity to go on the record. And if applicants are discussing projects, that they also discuss known opposition to the projects, just so that we've had some folks get caught up and not understand that there were opportunities for engagement here. And they thought that they had told the project proponent they had concerns, and that was the same as moving it forward, and we're working with them to resolve those issues. But just wanted to call attention to a specific aspect that might need some refinement of the actual application process.
And for those of you who are engaged in watching during the development of the transportation package through the Joint Committee on Transportation, there are a number of changes proposed to the Connect project as it moves through this new iteration as being part of the transportation package. So part of it has to do with funding source. Part of it has to do with the program itself. So a number of things are being proposed to be looked at very carefully as we analyze where the program is today and where we want it to go. So just stay tuned. There's a lot of balls in the air that deal with Connect Oregon right now.
Well, thank you. That sounds great. Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2288. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3231. Mr. Walker.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, House Bill 3231 allows governing bodies of cities and counties to jointly form district for the purposes of acquisition, design, construction, reconstruction, installation, operation, and maintenance of limited access public highway projects, outlines requirements for cities and counties to conduct hearings, hold elections, establish boundaries, and formation of board of directors to create special district. Describes conditions under which county may deny or approve application for a limited access public highway, clarifies proposed special district may enter into contracts and intergovernmental agreements, exercise eminent domain, assess, levy, and collect property taxes, enter into public-private partnerships, and issue and sell revenue bonds.
What I'd like to do is Representative Vile, have you open the hearing for us. We have 13 people here to testify, and we have about maybe 35 minutes. So I'm going to ask people to keep their testimony very short so we can get everybody in. And Representative Vile, we'll turn it over to you first.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. With me at the witness table is Jerry Willey, former mayor of Hillsborough, who was one of the co-chairs on the Transportation Futures Study in Washington County. And my legislative assistant, Caleb, is also here to assist me this morning. Like to thank the chair for the opportunity to have this bill heard. Also like to thank Representative Witt for his willingness to act as a co-chief sponsor, and Representative Noble as well as a additional signer on this bill. House Bill 3231 comes out of my experience this past summer and 30 years of cumulative experience with transportation challenges in the Washington County area. House District 26 includes areas of Wilsonville, Sherwood, South Hillsborough, King City, and rural Washington County, an area which has become increasingly congested and very, very difficult to move not only our commuter traffic, but our important business transportation traffic as well. Constituent feedback throughout the summer was that our system is simply broken. For 30 years as a land use lawyer, I have worked in this area and consistently heard of the West Side Bypass and other similar types of programs. These programs have never come to fruition. We have constantly told ourselves that if we can just get the right kind of alternative transit, more bike paths, more trains, more other types of transportation, that we would relieve the congestion. It has simply not happened, and it's time, we believe, for us to do something different. The congestion has created some dangerous routes. Cornelius Pass Road, for example, which is the only alternative for many types of goods to reach the Portland metro area because they cannot go through the tunnel on Highway 26, has become a particularly difficult spot. The farm-to-market roads, both in the Tualatin Valley and in the North Marion area, the French Prairie area, have also become a serious problem. You have a letter in opposition to the bill from the Marion County Board of Commissioners, which I think, interestingly, talks about the fact that so many of the folks in North Marion County are complaining about the fact that their farm-to-market roads have been essentially overtaken by commuters. It is important, I think, for us to recognize that these farm-to-market roads are a very important part of our transportation system and need to be protected. And one of the ways we can do that is by limited access highways. Limited access highways are a concept that essentially ensures that we continue to protect farmland in between the on-ramps and off-ramps for these highways. One of the big opposition pieces to this bill, as many of you I'm sure have seen, is that we are going to destroy farmland. In fact, I think the 65-year-old I-5 corridor between the Boone Bridge and Kaiser is the best example we have of how our land use system in Oregon really does protect farmland and at the same time allow us to have limited access highway transportation between key points. Our problem is
population. Representative
Vile,
yes. I'm noticing that you have 29 slides in this presentation.
It's 10 minutes.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm going to go through them.
All right, because we have a lot of people.
A whole bunch of them are going to be consolidated into one.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Population growth. By 2040, Hillsborough, another 30,000, Tigard, 20,000, Forest Grove, 12,000, Beaverton, 9,000. By the way, I didn't put King City on there. King City wants a whole bunch more folks. Unincorporated Washington County, 126,000, Portland metro area, 540,000. We can continue to tell ourselves that we'll solve this with trains, buses, and bikes, but I think that is a lie that we now need to recognize we can no longer afford to listen to. No major projects in this state since 1983, I-205. The green on this map is actually where repairs or major replacements are needed to the transportation system in Oregon. And I want to make one thing very clear right now. This bill does nothing to interfere with the very, very important transportation package that's being considered by this legislature right now. That package is critical. We're not asking for any money with this bill. We're only asking for a different way to look at funding major projects, which we have not been able to do for the last 60 years here in the state. So we need a new solution. We have an office in Colorado. E-470 in Colorado is a road that was built with no public funds, and it was built to relieve the congestion of I-25 down through the center of Denver. The E-470 Board of Directors is from 8 cities, 5 counties, and 1 town. No state or federal funding. They did use some vehicle registration fees from the local folks, investment income from some of the real estate management that along the route that they were able to use, and primarily toll revenues. It is one of the most expensive toll roads in the country. However, it is also one of the most used toll roads in the country and has consistently seen increasing use over the last few years. Let's go to the end of these slides if you can. This is just a brief history of tolling, and I won't do those, but I will tell you that tolling has had a very robust history in the United States, and it has been successful in most cases. This bill would allow local jurisdictions, and the irony of some of the opposition that we have heard from members of the local governments is that we're exactly trying to do what they're asking us to do, and that is give power back to the local governments. Let those folks along a route really consider it. Take, again, the North Marion County situation. These folks are saying, we don't want a bypass. That's fine. If you don't want a road in your area, don't join the group that is, in fact, looking at doing a road. If you don't want a road through your area, simply don't participate as a member of the Limited Access Highway District. That is completely up to the local folks as to whether they participate or don't participate. The public hearings that we've built into the bill and the board member elections are all designed to encourage that local access. It could get money from gifts, grants, donations, property taxes, toll charges, public-private partnerships, and revenue bonds. So we've built into it the complete variety. I want to address one last thing. Rural reserves are a big issue with respect to this bill. Let me explain that real quickly. When we adopted the urban-rural reserve compromise with respect to our land use urban growth boundary changes a few years ago, into the urban and rural reserve language was placed a statement that in rural reserves there would be no development. That has been interpreted by some counties as prohibiting even the building of a road, any kind of road, that constitutes development. This is a problem. If we cannot build roads, whatever kind of roads, but certainly limited access highways through rural reserves, we are forcing ourselves then to go out into a further area or to further urbanize closer in areas that might already be within the urban growth boundary, but really shouldn't have that kind of a limited access highway foisted upon them because of the cost of replacing existing housing. Managing the rural reserves part of our current land use system to accommodate this type of bill is a critical piece, and that is why it's in there. It's not intended to abrogate our land use system and the protection of farmland. The bill does have support from a variety of parties in all of the three counties that would be potentially affected in the scenario that I have proposed, as well as Washington State. We've worked closely with legislators in Washington State and have, as you'll see in the packet, support from legislators in Washington to assist with a connection. Now, in conclusion, I want to say this. This bill does not designate a route. This bill does not even designate an area. This bill could be used as much by Carl Wilson's constituents in Southern Oregon as it could be by Susan McLean's constituents in Washington County. This bill is designed to allow us to look at a new way to do things. But having said that, I think it's important that I confess that my hope is that this could be a vehicle that would help us do something that has been needed for a long, long time, and that is to get a solution to the congestion in Portland with an appropriate West Side reliever route. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Vile.
Welcome.
Good morning, and Madam Chair, Committee, thank you very much for a couple minutes here, and I will abbreviate based on your request. What has been provided in front of you is the full-blown copy and the executive version of the Washington County Futures Transportation Study. And I want to recognize as well, you're going to hear from, I was co-chair of that study, and my other co-chair, Miki Blizzard, is also going to testify a little differently than I'm testifying, but she was still a part of me on that study and a very important part. So over the 8 years that I was mayor of the city of Hillsborough, and by the way, I don't represent the city of Hillsborough today, so I'm a public citizen now, and so I want to make sure I indicate that. In the 8 years that I was mayor, though, the number one critical thing that people kept talking to me about was how do we manage growth and what are we going to do
about
congestion.
Sir, I'm sorry, we'll need your name for the record.
I'm sorry, Jerry Willie.
Thank you. That's all. We just need it officially on the record.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I should have done that.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, during that time, that's the things that we address. So when the 2013 legislature authorized $1.5 million for the county to have a study, that was a welcomed invitation to do something that we felt was very, very critical. It obviously took us a few years to get through that process. There was a committee of 14 people on it, and I was the only elected person, so we wanted to make sure that we had good citizen input. Some of the things that you're going to see on this study and on the future study, and certainly a couple of the slides, I don't know if we had them up there. Did you get them?
They should still be running.
Okay. The thing that we did as a committee is we had a number of discussions that just talked about congestion, but we also talked about what about the future, because that was the focal point of the study, was what kind of transportation modes and what kind of technology could we envision to have 30 or 40 or 50 years from now? That's difficult, because we all immediately envision, those of us who are my age, envision the Jetsons, and so that's how we're going to be buzzing around getting to work. Probably not going to happen in that fashion, but we wanted to hear what the other citizens of the county wanted, and so we put together a study, and we put it online. And hoping that we would receive a significant number of people to respond to this survey and tell us what they really thought. We received 5,400 people responded to that survey, which made it very statistically valid. And some of the results are all in this survey, and I won't go over those. But basically what you're seeing in the slide there is more people equals more jobs. What we do know for sure over the next 30 or 40 years, our region is going to significantly increase, not only in citizens, but in employment. So we need to get them from point A to point B, obviously, as efficiently as we possibly can, keeping in mind that every time we have congestion, we generate greenhouse gas and all the bad things that go along with that. So coming out of that survey, 79% of them felt that reduced freeway congestion was very important. 72% felt it was very important to improve traffic flow on major roads. And 71% reduced congestion on freeways connecting, wanted reduced congestion on freeways connecting to the county. As Representative Vile said, what happens when we have congestion is people figure out some way to go through the neighborhoods. These roads, these streets were not designed as commuter routes. We have to have other avenues to get people from point A to point B. While some other things that we talked about was that, as it says in the slide, 40 years reflects a 32% increase in trips into the county, a one-third increase, and 45% to other destinations, I'm sorry, and a 45% increase into the county. So it's very, very important that we have an improved and efficient transportation grid, certainly in the county. What we also figured out was that we don't live in a vacuum. We have, when we were talking about the roads that connect into the county, we could figure probably a dozen other jurisdictions that we needed to talk to, because all of their roads touch our roads, and all of their roads impact our roads and our efficiency. So with that, collaboration is going to be extremely important. And then I think one other thing that we cannot forget about is the freight industry. We've also done a freight industry study in the metro region, and certainly is important that our employment areas and our industry has the ability to get their goods to market in a fast way, and right now that is not it. I think statewide it's pretty well known that even in the ag industry, it's very, very difficult to get product through the metro region. So with that, what does that have to do with this bill? I think it's just another way that we can begin considering some other alternatives that up to now we do not have. And I think if I had to leave you with one message, there's a lot of opposition to that, as Representative Vile has already pointed out. In the book Good to Great in 2001, Jim Collins used a term that I've used many times during my 8 years as mayor, and is the tyranny of the or. When we start thinking about these kinds of decisions, these are major changes in our decision process. We can't use the or. It can't be that or this. It has to be a collaborated start, has to be a collaborated discussion, and we all need to work together so we can get to yes and make something work efficiently. So that's what I'd encourage the committee to do, is not think about this as an either-or project, but how do we get to yes? Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Representative Mile, how much is there to be learned from E-470? I take that a lot from DIA down to Highlands Ranch when I go there frequently. What is there to learn from that, and is this somewhat of a template for this project?
Chair McEwen, Representative Wilson, I actually talked with former Governor Bill Owen, who was one of the architects of the E-470 project, and his story is fascinating in that there was a lot of opposition at the beginning, but by making sure that all of the cities and counties along a particular route had essentially an equal say and the opportunity to participate in that process, that ultimately led to its success. E-470 is one of the most successful highways in the U.S. right now, even though it also has one of the highest tolls. And according to Governor Owen, the template that I used to ask LC to draft this bill, which was essentially the same legislation that they had used, had evolved over a number of years. And so we had the benefit of the mistakes they made early in coming up with this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. I'd like to call next Mr. Brentano, Commissioner Cameron, Janet Carlson, and if I have your titles wrong, please excuse me. And if you could be
yes,
as brief as possible. Thank you.
Good morning, and thank you, Chair McCown. Good to see you.
McEwen.
Thank you. I was going to do it right.
Happens all the time. You get a pass.
And members of the committee, my name is Sam Brentano, and I'm the chair this year of the Marion County Board of Commissioners. We just want to talk about, we've heard some reassurances that, no, you're not involved, but it always looks like involved. For decades, at least two of them, we've had different plans to relieve congestion from Washington and Yamhill counties by coming through North Marion County. Looks like the place you ought to go. Wide open, sparsely populated, relatively flat, connects with the freeway. And we've been fighting that for all these two decades. Our current, our legislative delegation is really helpful. The project we are working on hard to reduce congestion in the area is the Newburgh-Dundee bypass to make sure it really does bypass Newburgh-Dundee and comes back to Highway 99 and not just dump into Marion County. And then we have a special emphasis. We're looking at the Donald Interchange. Just doesn't work. I might just quickly tell you, if you're ever on the freeway, be aware that traffic can stop at any time right there as a bottleneck. Marion County is a top egg producer in Oregon, and it is our industry, and we're just not interested in damaging our number one industry nor the rural lifestyle of our population to facilitate somebody else's need. Bisecting, interrupting farms and farm operations, and we understand progress. We just want that progress to go somewhere else. So real quickly, for 20 years, we've made the same resolutions. We said the same statements. We'll be opposed to anything that even looks like it could dump into Marion County. It's been going on 2001, 2006, 2010, 13, and now today. So every 3 or 4 years, a different version comes trotting out, and I don't buy the assurances that this doesn't look like we're out of go. Commissioner Cameron, would you?
Commissioner Cameron, I'd like to welcome you. My freshman year, I sat on transportation with you and looked to you for guidance at times, and I'm delighted to have you back in this committee, sir.
And,
thank you for your
and
service.
And look how far we've come, Madam Chair. But you're sitting there and I'm sitting
How about
there.
That?
There's something wrong with this picture. It's great to be back. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, Kevin Cameron, Marion County Commissioner. It's good to be before you today, and I just want to state up front that I think there's some agreement here between the proponents of this bill and us. There is a traffic problem throughout this state. There is a transportation problem throughout the state that needs to be addressed. And I want won't go into the other issues as to, you know, the challenges in passing a transportation package, which is probably the right way to go. But I know you have some challenges here before you to make that happen. I do want to say a couple of things about North Marion County. We have had two meetings. We just had one two or three weeks ago at St. Paul, where we had about 85 people in the room. And I was handed petitions with over 500 signatures on that. And one of the four requirements on this petition that they were demanding that the Marion County Commissioners act on was to oppose any bill or any bypass through North Marion County in the farmland. I want to make a distinction also between, I lived in Aurora, Colorado, and in fact, a representative and I have had this discussion. I used to tell people I lived in Kansas when I lived in Aurora, Colorado, because to the east, there was nothing but flat grain, non-irrigated land. And this land that we're talking about in North Marion County, as Commissioner said, we are the number one ag-producing county gross farm gate in Oregon. And we need to feed not only Oregon, but the rest of the world and the United States. We need to do everything to preserve that. So with that, I just want to make sure that we are listening to some of the challenges we have. Our number one priority in Marion County that we have signed on to is not even in, as far as transportation, is not even in Marion County. It's the Newburgh-Dundee bypass that was passed in the 2007 transportation bill, and we are encouraging ODOT to buy that, to get that finished, because that is sending traffic down farm roads into the Aurora area. So we just want to encourage you to make sure that we're doing the things that we need to do to improve our transportation system and protecting farmland at the same time. So thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing us to be here today.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Janet Carlson, Marion County Commissioner. And I'll just quickly tag on to what my fellow commissioners have said. First of all, we're very much for transportation strategies and relieving congestion. And I guess the word that comes to my mind is, but we're wary, all right? We have, as Commissioner Brentano said, signed on. I've signed on personally twice to the resolutions that you have in the packet before you about North Marion County and protecting farmland there and so much opposition to having what was called the Coastal Parkway. I can recall, however, the advocates for that Coastal Parkway, after we've signed these resolutions and told them specifically we didn't want them, they came and presented in public comment before the Board of Commissioners. We thanked them for their testimony, and then the next day we get a call from the Yamhill County Commissioners. Have you changed your position? Well, no. I mean, we said, heck no, and heck no. But because we said thank you, they said, we think they're coming around. And so that was in the front page of the newspaper in Yamhill County. So we've had these conversations with them and been very, very clear, and it just keeps kind of rearing its head. So the concern that we have, our legal counsel actually took a look at the language of the bill. I won't read you the printed testimony, but you should have it in front of you. There's bulleted items about the fact that the counties don't have to be contiguous, for example, and roads generally start somewhere and end somewhere. So hypothetically, if you had a coastal county like Lincoln or Tillamook and you had Yamhill County agreeing and you had Clackamas County agreeing and it had to come through somewhere, does that put pressure on Marion County, the annexation provisions, the idea that you have to just accept the toll road and only look at construction standards? So those are the kinds of concerns that we have. So if this bill moves forward, we would urge you to just seal it up so that there is no way that a county or a jurisdiction that doesn't want something going through there would be forced to do it, or somehow there'd be a workaround, and we'd be in a position where the local government would have no say in what went forward. So that's our big concern.
Thank you. Brief questions, Representative Evans.
Very brief, more of a statement. There are three county commissioners in Marion County, is that correct? And all three are here.
That's
in some
correct.
Counties across the state, there are more. I just want to make sure that all three Marion County commissioners are here, all saying the same thing. Thank you for being here today.
Doesn't happen very often.
Certainly has our attention.
Thank you very much. Next, I'd like to call John Charles. Let's see. Shulton, Washington County, and Meeky Blizzard, Washington County, please. Welcome back, Mr. Charles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Charles, President of Cascade Policy Institute. I'm here in support of the bill. I should say that I'm agnostic about the exact
governance structure. I think the governance structure as proposed is fine. It's also possible that if you were interested and you sent this to a work group, that creative people could come up with some other governance structure. Maybe we need to carve out part of the Portland highway system and create a turnpike commission, and this could be this or other things could be part of that. I'm agnostic about that, but I do believe that we have a need for this, as the as Representative Vile said originally. If you have I-205 opening in 1983 and you declare victory and decide that we're done with highways forever, which is pretty much the attitude of this state, I think that's pretty unworkable. Almost everybody who's here today, when they leave, if they're in a car, which most will be, they're probably going to use I-5. It was fine that someone else did all the heavy lifting to build that. Our attitude now is, we just can't do that in the future. I believe that's wrong. I think there is a need. The other alternatives have a place, but they haven't worked. They won't work enough in the future. And also, tolling is the obvious financing mechanism. Not only did it work in Colorado, it is working in dozens of places all around the world today. It's not even cutting edge anymore. 100% cost recovery by users with electronic tolling, variable pricing, designed to ensure free flow conditions 24/7. That's what's happening. It's just not happening in the little backwater of Oregon. I think something like this needs to move forward. It could be modified greatly, but something like it should move forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome, ma'am.
Chairwoman, Representative McEwen, and members of the committee, my name is Dick Scouten. I'm on the Washington County Board of Commissioners, and I would say the county board is pretty split on this. Two of us are strongly opposed. I would say that our chair praises faintly this project. So Alexander Pope said that you could damn with faint praise. So the board is split. But I do, in my comments, speak for both Commissioner Malinowski, myself, as well as a couple of Beaverton councilors, Lacey Bietti and Mark Sanssouci, and Forest Grove Mayor Peter Truax. With the exception that I would say that I would think about the concept of tolling, but I think the concept of tolling is quite separate and apart from this bill. Let me also say that we really appreciate all of us on our Board of Commissioners represent, respect and appreciate Representative Vile's service for the County Board. He's been on the Fair Board, past good service there, as well as currently, and past good work on the County Planning Commission. So thank you for that. Some of us just disagree with this particular act. I think particularly our concern is the fatal flaw of vesting a special district with single purpose, building a limited access freeway, would have its own independent board of elected officials, considerable powers, including, I think, the very scary one that it would have any other powers that are required to effectuate the act. We already have a lot of strong jurisdictions that are working on transportation, looking at it in a very holistic way. This special district is just poor governance. It's just not the way to be doing this. The county has done very well, economically, and I think part of that is our close cooperation among us. We have a Washington County Coordinated Committee. We work also regionally through the Joint Powers Authority, or I should say the Joint Powers, Committee, the JPAC. We work together, and we think through all the aspects of transportation, because after all, that's not an end in itself. It's simply a means to economic development, livability, environmental issues, public health. Those things could simply be ignored by this special district. It's a district that could run amok. Poor governance, and we have to take a look at this holistically and take a look at it from the policy standpoint. We can talk about particular projects. We know the West Side Bypass is animating this in particular. It's not a reason. I personally think, and I think many others think, that that's not really the way to solve our congestion problems. It's actually going to make it worse. Terribly not cost-effective. What we could do with $20 billion in terms of light rail, in terms of safe routes to school, building a network of connected arterials, I think of projects like connecting Murray to Wallace Street and Tigard and so forth. That's where the money should be going. It needs to be going inside our districts, inside the urban growth boundary areas. Building this bypass is proven to be, over the many years, to be something that does not solve congestion problems, adds to induced demand, and doing the same thing that we have been doing in America. It's not cutting edge. It's stuff we've been doing in America since the Second War, and doing the same thing over again and not seeing solutions is not really very smart. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair McEwen and committee members. My name is Miki Blizzard. I'm a Washington County resident and have been there for about 40 years. And for the past nearly 20 years, I've been involved in transportation issues at the local, regional, and national level. And as Jerry Willey made a statement earlier, I co-chaired with him the recent Washington County Transportation Futures Committee, which looked at a variety of transportation options for the county for the next 50 years. The study itself did not come up with any specific recommendations, but there's a lot of good data there, and they can be interpreted differently. But one of the things we were looking at was really how to invest more cost-effectively in terms of transit, public access to roads and streets, and for pedestrians and bicyclists. I oppose House Bill 3231 for basic reasons. I've submitted some testimony, so I'll keep this really short. But the first point is that we really do not need the creation of a special district to solve our transportation needs. It seems to me that that is certainly undercutting the role that you play, the role that the legislature plays, the roles that the counties play in planning their own future. Particularly in regarding to rural reserves. There's a reason that roads are not included in rural reserves. I'd hate to see that undercut. And also I would like to see the fact that the robust process that we use in the greater metro area with metro transportation planning would undercut that as well. As you know, better than most, we have a huge backlog of current transportation needs. And creating a special district that does have taxing authorities, revenue from bonds and so forth was one of the things that Representative Vile listed as a source. People do not want to be taxed to increase a transportation system that we don't even have the money to maintain. So we think it would be far too expensive to do that. And the fact that there's been a lack of funding through the past 20, 30, 40 years for new freeways, that indicates a lack of support. If you have a lack of support, you don't change the rules. You find out ways to get that support through existing process, and I think our process works quite well. Building a new limited access freeway to ease traffic flow is simply a waste of money. Metro areas throughout the United States have found that if we provide alternatives to driving, people do take those. Does congestion disappear? No, it will always be with us, but we need to find ways to deal with that that are cost-effective, that are sustainable, and that create more livable communities.
Ma'am, I'll need to ask you to wrap up so we can
one more
to the rest
Thank
of
you.
Our folks.
I will
Thank
do
you.
That. Thank you. And technology is quickly transforming our entire transportation system. It would take at least 20 years to get a facility such as Representative Vile is proposing built. 20 years from now, we have no idea what our transportation system is going to look like. And I hope that you've been talking with Intel about the role that they've been playing in transportation technology. So I urge you not to move this bill forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Next, I would like to call Catherine Harrington, Kathleen Carl, and Robert Bailey, please. And while we're changing seats, I'll note to what the future may hold. We've already had a hearing on autonomous vehicles. Today we're hearing about auto cycles. Who knows what the future is going to hold? Welcome.
Thank you, Chair McEwen, members of the committee. My name is Catherine Harrington. I'm the Metro Councilor for District 4 in Washington County. I'll briefly summarize my written testimony.
Thank you.
As you know, Metro is the elected regional government of the 24-city, 3-county Portland metropolitan area. We're responsible, among other things, for developing a 25-year regional transportation plan, both to have an efficient and reliable transportation system and to meet federal air quality requirements, as well as the state requirements from the 2009 Jobs and Transportation Act to reduce transportation-related carbon emissions. We pride ourselves on our collaboration with numerous local governments and agency partners, as well as with businesses, community groups, and public in the development of this plan. House Bill 3231 would authorize a district that would operate completely around outside this well-established process with potentially dire consequences. The Metro Council has two broad categories of concern that cause us to oppose this bill. The first has to do with feasibility and need. To our knowledge, there has been no analysis of the economic or market viability of a limited access tollway like the one we understand is intended by this bill. Until we have an idea that such a facility could feasibly be built with tolls and that people would be willing to pay whatever those tolls would be, it's very premature to authorize the creation of a new single-purpose government for that purpose. Our second area of concern is much more important. It has to do with accountability and coordination. This district that could be created under this bill would operate entirely outside of the existing processes for highway planning and would have virtually unlimited authority to ignore critical public protections that ensure consistency and help avoid unintended consequences. This lack of accountability and consultation would allow the construction of a highway that could cause our region to violate federal air quality regulations, with potentially terrible consequences for economic development and industrial growth. Specifically, this could affect the ability of industry to expand in the region by eliminating what is known as the Industrial Growth Allowance, a provision that depends on keeping the transportation-related air pollution below federal limits.
And ma'am, I'm going to ask if you submitted written testimony that we can read that on
the
list.
Just one point that it is not in there.
Thank you.
Intel and Portland General Electric are just two examples of companies that have been able to use this tool to expand their operations in the region, thereby creating new tools and tax revenues. At a time when we're working hard with the legislature to come up with $1 billion to address critical transportation bottlenecks in our region, this bill is an unnecessary distraction. We urge you not to move it forward. Thank you.
And again, if you've submitted written testimony, if you could summarize very briefly, that would be helpful.
My name is Kathleen Carl. My family's been farming for five generations in Hubbard, Oregon, and before that in Coos County. So a couple of things. I did submit testimony. I'm going to say something completely different. One thing, when you are on a farm, and as you know, farmers are a very, very small percentage of the population. So if a city decides to, and they will have eminent domain under this, if they decide you are not on the city council because you live outside the city limits, so the city decides they're going to build this road through your place, but an eminent domain on your farm, of Representative Vile, you said if your city doesn't want to, they won't do it. But as farmers out there in the country, we aren't on the city council, so they decide it, they go through our land. The second thing I wanted to talk about was the rural reserves. I know farmers in those rural reserves, and they believe that they were protected. This was a process with the rural reserves, which Metro and three counties and farmers worked really hard to create, and the legislature approved what they had decided on. To say that you can now go through these rural reserves and just say, we're going to go right through them, what are you doing? I know, because our farm is on a road that once you put a road through things, it changes everything. You keep agriculture together by protecting it. So I just feel like this is really disrespectful of the system we have for protecting farms through rural reserves and Oregon's land use laws, and this protections our state has created. So I oppose this very much.
Thank you so much. And I will refer that there is a number of pieces of written testimony here that you can look up on all this. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Chair McEwen and Council. I'm Robert Bailey. I'm representing Save Helvetia. We got started about 11 years ago following Senate Bill 1011 in Washington County with the reserves process. We ended up appealing to the State Court of Appeals. The State Court of Appeals threw out the Washington County plan as not having followed the law. We've been concerned with farmland protection ever since. We're concerned that this would abrogate the grand bargain that the legislature participated in. It's not good citizen participation to do local land use planning at the legislative level. It would be very destructive to farmland. Senate Bill 1011 that you passed a number of years ago was sold under the promise of creating certainty for farmers and developers and urban planners. This would pull the rug out from under that certainty that you promised and create speculative value across a broad swath of prime farmland in Washington County. We have heard from past Governor Willie with his report on the Futures Study. That study group did not endorse this bill, although the pamphlet that you got might appear to. It did not. Washington County has no official position on it. I was offered to carpool some farmers down here today. They're busy with pesticides and mold control. You're not likely to get them off their vocation to hear, but I have heard from them and wanted to pass that on. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Questions briefly for the panel. All right. Thank you. We have three to go, and then we have two work sessions, so be patient, committee. Mary Kyle McCurdy, Jerry Bohard, Mary Ann Nash.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair McHugh, and I'll just start.
Please.
I'm members of the committee. Mary Kyle McCurdy, representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I'm going to cut to the quick. We oppose this bill. And you've heard about the value of farmland in Marion County, Clackamas, Washington, Yamhills County that are threatened by this project. But I'm going to, and I've talked about that in our testimony, but I'm going to concentrate on how this is really an outdated concept, and it will not build us a transportation system that we need for this century that we're in, and also will not relieve congestion. And this isn't just a conclusion of organizations like 1,000 Friends. It's coming from industry analysts. In my testimony, I quoted from Pricewaterhouse's international business consulting firm, which concludes that the best solution to congestion is not, in fact, building another road, bridge, or tunnel. Over the past several decades, brute construction to meet the needs of drivers has been the default approach for many cities, yet this strategy has generated more traffic, and instead of one congested road, it's created two. We believe that how well this issue is addressed will shape the productivity and competitiveness of cities for the foreseeable future, and mass transit must be upgraded substantially. The same conclusion about the futility of building one's way out of congestion with new roads also comes from an unlikely source, Houston, Texas. The current mayor of Houston concluded, quote, "The traditional strategy of adding capacity, especially single-occupant vehicle capacity, on the periphery of our urban areas exacerbates urban congestion problems. These types of projects are not creating the kind of vibrant, economically strong cities that we all desire." The mayor pointed out that the recent expansion of the Katy Freeway in Houston, that's Interstate 10, to 26 lanes in some places at a cost of $2.8 billion actually increased rush hour travel times, and one segment is now the top congested freeway in Texas. But here in Oregon, we're already doing better, and we should continue our investments in forward transportation planning. We are seeing significant positive results of two decades of transit, bicycle, and pedestrian investments and current road connectivity and improvements in Portland and in Oregon. In Oregon, statewide, both per capita vehicle miles traveled and total vehicle miles traveled have declined from 1999 to 2013, a time when the state's population growth rate exceeded the national average, when the state's GDP growth rate was amongst the top in the nation, and vehicle registrations actually increased by 17%, and still statewide driving decreased. And the Portland metropolitan region is showing similar trends. I'll just say one example using safe routes to schools and Washington County in particular. It's estimated that 15 to 20% of the morning AM peak congestion in Washington County is from people driving their kids to schools. Imagine if we invested in safe ways of getting to school so people don't have to drive their kids there. That is a great way to reduce congestion and meet several bottom lines, and a lot cheaper. Thank you.
You'll be pleased with Senator Beyer's proposal for the transportation package, I'm sure. Ms. Bohart.
Jerry Bohart, the Oregon Department of Transportation. I have provided written testimonies. I just have points for you to think about should this move forward. That there really has been no analysis of what the impact might be to the existing infrastructure, so no requirement to look at if these roadways do occur, how they would connect to the existing system. There is a recommendation in there that federal funds might be used for these roadways. Those often have rules and regulations and limitations on how they could be used, so that may be something to consider moving forward. And I think finally there's a suggestion that DMV would be used for enforcement purposes. If private funds are used for the building of these tollways, that would be something difficult for DMV to do because of the state highway fund limitations. So those may just be some hurdles to think about moving forward.
Thank you. Ms. Nash, welcome back.
Thank you. Chair McKeown, members of the committee, Mary Ann Nash from the Oregon Farm Bureau here today. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 3231. We want to start by thanking Vice Chair Vile for approaching us about this bill earlier in the session and answering some of our initial questions. Efficient and effective transportation is an issue of utmost concern for our members, and we support improving road infrastructure to make transportation more efficient. However, our members' farms are also located in rural areas, which are often looked at for transportation corridors, so we understandably pay close attention to the siting and construction of transportation facilities. While we appreciate the bill's focus on local collaboration to resolve difficult transportation issues, we have some remaining questions about how the proposed process would move forward that we would like to see addressed as these conversations proceed. So we look forward to remaining part of the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? All right, everyone, thank you very much for being here. I'm going to close our public hearing on House Bill 3231. We have two work sessions that I would like to get through. We're going to be a couple of minutes late, but please indulge me, committee members. Work session on House Bill 2463, Mr. Walker.
Chair McKeown, members of the committee, House Bill 2463 expands the circumstances under which the Department of Transportation may enter into an agreement with an integrator, declares an emergency and effective upon passage. There is a no revenue impact that has been issued and a no fiscal impact has been issued. We have in front of us a dash two amendment that replaces the bill. It allows the Department of Transportation to assign certain duties to a third party for the purposes of carrying out vehicle-related transactions for which the department is responsible and the processing of fees or taxes for vehicle-related transactions. Since we have all of the appropriate paperwork, we can move this if that is the desire of the committee.
The committee, would you like me to invite ODOT up? Do you have questions about this, or are you ready to move it? All right. Vice Chair Vile.
Chair McKeown, I move to adopt the dash two amendment dated 3/9/17.
Vice Chair Vile moves to adopt the dash two amendment dated 3/9/17. Is there any discussion? Yes.
Hey, Chair, thank you. I just wanted to say that I had an amendment drafted, but I withdrew that. I was disappointed that we had to do that, but I'm still going to vote yes for the bill.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate the comment. Any further discussion? Clerk, will you call the roll, please? I'm sorry. We're going to adopt the amendment. Then we're going to turn back to Vice Chair Vile. I'm getting ahead of myself here.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2463 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Vile moves House Bill 2463 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, Clerk, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Representative Barreto.
Aye.
Representative Evans.
Yes.
Representative McClain.
Aye.
Representative Noble.
Aye.
Vice Chair Meek.
Aye.
Vice Chair Vile.
Aye.
Chair McKeown.
Aye. The motion passes. Do I have a carrier for this? Someone want to volunteer to carry this bill?
Sure.
Representative Wilson, thank you. All right. I will close the work session on House Bill 2463. And we will open a work session on House Bill 2749. Mr. Walker. Okay. Mr. Walker.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, House Bill 2749 was in front of you on March 22nd. The bill directs the Port of Hood River and the Department of Transportation to study the feasibility of replacing the Hood River White Salmon Bridge, authorizes issuance of $5 million in lottery bonds to finance the study, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage. The bill has a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, and we have the paperwork necessary to move the bill. It has two amendments. The dash one replaces the bill and removes references to the Department of Transportation and directs the Port of Hood River to conduct a study and report to the Legislative Assembly no later than December 31st, 2018. The dash two replaces the bill also. It directs the Port of Hood River to conduct a study and report to the Legislative Assembly no later than December 31st, 2018. And the study must evaluate environmental impacts, engineering requirements and design and construction options, cost and financing options, and project delivery methods and schedules.
And I think I would like to invite Ms. Horner up to address the two amendments. Are the proponents of the bill in the room that have...
Thank you. Good morning, Chair McEwen and members of the committee. Leah Horner with the Oregon Department of Transportation. We've worked closely with the proponents of the bill on both the dash one and the dash two amendments. I think that we as an agency would be fine implementing either of the dash one or the dash two. We have a slight tendency of a preference towards the dash one and would continue to work with the Port of Hood River on an agreement as well as making sure that all of the elements of the bill are implemented appropriately.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, Dan Bates for the record, representing the Port of Hood River. I couldn't echo those comments more. We've appreciated the working with ODOT, have a preference for the dash one, and happy to answer any questions.
Dash one it is. Thank you very much. That's what I needed to know.
Chair McEwen, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated 4-2-2017.
Vice Chair Meek moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated 4-3-2017. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
Do we know if the Port of Hood River 1 is a subsidiary of the state of Oregon? And number 2, do we have legal authority to direct them to do anything?
I'm going to invite Mr. Bates back up.
Chair McEwen, Representative Way. Thanks for the question. I believe they are a subsidiary of the state of Oregon as a local government. I would have to check on the legal definition to get more clarification for you on that. I fully believe that you can do what the bill asks you to do, which is to direct us to do this with this funding. We asked for the language. I haven't had counsel suggest to me that that was inappropriate.
Okay, further questions, sir?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Let's see. Where are we? Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
Chair McEwen, I move House Bill 2749 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Meek moves House Bill 2749 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Clerk, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Representative Barreto.
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yep.
Representative McQueen?
Aye.
Representative Noble?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Meek?
Aye.
Vice Chair Miles?
Aye.
Chair McEwen?
Aye. The motion passes. We do not need a carrier. Oh, anything else? And I will close the work session on House Bill, where's my number, 2749. Anything for the good of the order this morning? Committee, thank you for your indulgence. Oh, yes, and we will be carrying over House Bill 2750 and House Bill 2320 for various reasons. Some have to do with paperwork and others. So those will be rolled over to next Wednesday. Mr. Walker, a quick update on next Wednesday. It will be a very busy meeting next Wednesday.
Next Wednesday, we'll have three public hearings and possible work sessions, and we've got eight work sessions on various bills that have been before us before, and we have an agenda scheduled for the 14th in case we need to carry bills over from the 12th.
So keep next Friday morning open.
And we are off this Friday.
We are off this Friday, but keep next Friday on your schedules from 8 to 9 in case we need it. We are adjourned. Thank you, Danielle.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
In case we need it. We are adjourned. Thank you, Danielle.
Thank you, Madam Chair.